Over the course of this retreat so far, as you know, we've been weaving together all of these different methods, approaches, practices from all kinds of different traditions. And we've been focusing a lot on the wisdom aspect of the practice, just understanding the conceits, the views, the self-views, the cravings, the clingings, all the things that get in the way and cause dukkha. And so tonight I thought it might be time to look at another whole set of practices, the heart practices known as the four Brahmavihara, namely kindness or metta, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And so these four beautiful qualities of heart and mind are ones that we can train in. And with practice, with training, they can start to become more and more the default setting of our hearts and minds. In fact, in the Buddha's understanding, they are the natural state of our heart and mind when it's not being visited by, what's the term? I've forgotten it, but there's a adventitious defilements. There's a fancy way of saying visiting afflictive states, bad house guests, you could say. So just before I go into a little bit more about what these qualities are, the term Brahmavihara itself, it's difficult to translate into English because the word Brahma refers to a kind of god that was worshipped in the Brahmin tradition in India at the time of the Buddha. And we don't really have any equivalent for that in our own culture. So it's sometimes translated as heaven instead. So you hear the Brahmavihara referred to as the heavenly realms. And the vihara part means dwelling place. So Brahmavihara can literally mean the dwelling place of Brahma, but it's more usually translated as divine abodes or sublime abidings or heavenly realms or boundless states. And I wanted to highlight this aspect of vihara as being home, because as I just said, these four states are in fact our true home. When our hearts and minds are not assailed by stress, distress, difficulty, this is where we naturally abide or dwell. And there's a sense of ease there, just as there is in our physical homes. They're a place or state where we can feel relaxed and comfortable and more who we truly are. So the second aspect of the term Brahmavihara that I like to highlight is the quality of boundlessness. So again, sometimes these four qualities are referred to as the four immeasurables. And as Nick mentioned last night, the Pali word for immeasurable is apamana. Apamana. And we can hear a direct connection between the term mana, meaning conceit, comparing mind, and apamana, which means beyond measuring, beyond comparing, beyond any kind of conceit or conceiving. So the idea is that we can cultivate kindness and compassion, appreciative joy and equanimity so fully that they become unlimited, boundless, completely unconditional. Now, that's a pretty high bar, so just before that idea might start to reinforce any pre-existing conditions of inadequacy, remember that these are practices. They're trainings. And through regularly practicing them, cultivating them, they naturally, gradually develop to the point where we can abide in them more and more often. So far on this retreat, we've spent some time with metta, kindness, and karuna, compassion, in the two insight dialogue practices that I offered. So this evening, I thought to focus a little more on the third Brahmavihara, which is mudita. I like to translate it as appreciative joy, but it's also commonly translated as sympathetic joy or altruistic joy or just simply gladness, as we see in the chant that we've been doing in the evenings. So just a little bit more context about how the four qualities are interrelated, and an encouragement to practice with all four of them. You know, so often on retreats we just hear about metta, and the other three might be referred to in passing. But if we want to receive the full benefit of the Brahmavihara, so just like a four-ply piece of rope, four strands of rope is stronger than a single ply piece of rope. In the same way, these four Brahmavihara really work together to powerfully strengthen our hearts and minds. And they act as very powerful, effective protections against the hindrances, in fact, against all afflictive mind states. So in my own practice, I got interested in the interrelationship between these four Brahmavihara. It's quite a few years ago now. It was during a retreat at the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts. And I was working with one teacher who was talking about the nature of mind. And he quoted the 19th century Tibetan meditation master Shabkar. And that quote said, "The mind nature is vivid as a flawless piece of crystal, intrinsically empty, naturally radiant, ceaselessly responsive." And at the time, that phrase, I don't know why, it just really struck me. The mind nature is vivid as a flawless piece of crystal, intrinsically empty, naturally radiant, ceaselessly responsive. And at that time on retreat, I'd been practicing the Brahmavihara pretty intensively for a few weeks. And when I heard about the mind being like a flawless piece of crystal, that quality of transparency made sense to me. Because when the heart mind is perfectly clear, it just naturally responds in the appropriate way, with kindness or compassion, joy or equanimity, just as a diamond naturally responds to light. So sometimes the diamond flashes red, sometimes blue, sometimes yellow. And all of these different colors are possible because of the diamond's innate purity. So I was thinking about this image of the diamond, and I started to imagine a traditional diamond shape with four points as an expression of how these Brahmavihara relate to each other. So if you just for a moment look, if you think of a diamond shape like that, on the bottom point of the diamond is metta. And metta is at the bottom because at least in the Theravada tradition, it's seen as the foundation that the other three develop from. So then when metta turns towards difficulty, suffering, it manifests as compassion. When we take that basic goodwill and turn it towards pain, then compassion is the natural response. So we can think of compassion as being one of the side points of the diamond. Then in a similar way, when that same foundation of metta, of kindness, friendliness, turns towards what's going well, towards happiness and success, it naturally manifests as appreciative joy or mudita. And this is the ability to feel happiness, appreciation for another's happiness. So you could think of mudita as being at the opposite side point of the diamond, opposite compassion. Then when joy and compassion are completely in balance, they come together to support equanimity. So I located equanimity at the apex of the diamond, because equanimity is the heart mind that is totally at ease, without any reactivity, just resting, poised, balanced. So one way that this diamond arrangement could be helpful is to illustrate how the different Brahmavihara might be used to balance each other out. So for example, if the metta starts to feel a bit dry or maybe superficial, we could change to compassion practice for a while. When we tune into suffering with an attitude of kindness, It can strengthen a sense of purpose and maybe bring more depth to the metta. There are times, though, you might have experienced when we can start to get bogged down. If there's too much focus on suffering, we can start to feel overwhelmed by, in the Taoist tradition, what are known as the 10,000 sorrows. And if that starts to happen, it might be a good idea to deliberately turn towards the 10,000 joys, so we can start to incline the heart-mind towards appreciative joy, towards mudita, and really cultivate gratitude for what's going well in our own and others' lives. Sometimes, though, people get a bit stuck in mudita and it can become a kind of effusive, ungrounded elation or an attachment to pleasantness. And then equanimity can become appropriate, just consciously cultivating that balance of heart and mind. In fact, equanimity is useful antidote to any kind of imbalance. And that's another reason that it's at the top of the diamond, because metaphorically it's the pinnacle of all of these mind states. Okay, so coming back to mudita or appreciative joy, I think that perhaps of all the four Brahmavihara, it's the one that seems to get the least attention. And I've been wondering why that is, and I think there's a whole range of different reasons. One is probably just what we've referred to a few times now, the mind's inbuilt negativity bias. There just is that tendency to just go to what's unpleasant, towards what's difficult, painful, challenging. So we have this bias in the mind away from what's pleasant that can make it difficult to really open to joy. There's also a broader cultural societal conditioning. And I think most of us here have been brought up in societies that tend to value individualism and self-reliance and competitiveness. So the idea of celebrating somebody else's success and happiness, in some ways it's pretty countercultural. And if we've been too immersed in that kind of conditioning, that kind of individuality, then when somebody else gets something good, there can be a sense of, but I'm missing out. We can have a poverty mentality or a lack mentality that unconsciously assumes that somebody else's good fortune, somebody else's success or happiness must be coming at the expense of our own. And so again, it can be counterintuitive to really open up to other people's joy, happiness, success. So it's fortunate that, like all of the Brahmavihara, mudita is a quality that can be actively cultivated. Something we can train in and strengthen and deepen. And like all of the Brahmavihara, the encouragement is to start where it comes most easily. So if you're new to this practice, you might just start auditioning people in your life for where mudita might come most easily. And usually it's best to start with someone where we have a fairly simple or straightforward relationship. So perhaps a small child, if you have little kids in your life, maybe grandchildren or nieces or nephews or neighbors with kids. It can be relatively easy to feel a sense of mudita. You might think or remember a time when that little kid started walking for the first time. And maybe there's just that look of amazement and delight on that kid's face when they managed to take their first steps. Perhaps that's something that naturally brings mudita. Or maybe if the kid's a bit older, you might think about they come back from tell you about their new friend at school. Or maybe tell you how they got the trophy for most improved player in their sports. But although I've actually received a few of most improved player trophies, and I always find that's a bit ambivalent somehow. Not quite the raging mudita fest that it might seem like. So for some people, actually non-human beings are an easier place to start. And for some people, dogs are a powerful source of mudita, or cats. I think there's a reason why there are some billion dog and cat videos on YouTube and elsewhere. But you can think of an actual dog example. Someone in the US was telling me about how they got a new dog, and it was in winter, and they watched as this dog was let off the leash for the first time after a snowstorm, and the dog just jumped right into the first snowdrift, muzzle first, and then it jumped out in astonishment, and it shook all the snow off, and it just looked totally bemused, and then it did it again, and it just kept jumping in and out of all these deep snowdrifts, and its tail was just going crazy because it was so excited. And you might have a sense of that dog's sheer delight, maybe feel some mudita. Now, maybe for some of you, dogs aren't your thing. But when I was putting this talk together on mudita a while back, I started remembering an experience I had a few years ago with my mother when we were walking along the beach where my parents live in Northland. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and we noticed there was a woman paddling a surf ski just out beyond the breaking waves. She was pretty close inshore. And so we were looking at her thinking, well, this must be a nice experience. And then I saw a fin appear in the water behind her. And my first reaction was jaws. And then I realized, oh, phew, it's not a shark, it's the dolphin. And then I saw another one and another one and another one. And this whole pod of dolphins swam up to the woman and completely surrounded her. And some of the dolphins were mothers with babies. And we could see that the dolphins were playing. They'd dive under the surf ski and then pop up on the other side and just look at the woman with these big dolphin grins. And a little while later, the woman came in and she was literally shaking from head to toe. She was just vibrating with happiness. And she said she'd been coming to that beach for decades and she had never had an experience like that. And she said at first she was a little worried. She thought maybe they were trying to attack her or get her out of their territory. But she noticed how the mother would dive down and then the baby would dive down and they'd come up and look at each other and then look at her and then they'd dive down and pop up on the other side. And they were very deliberately, obviously, playing with her. So again, you might just get a sense, or is there some flicker of mudita as you imagine that experience? So what this practice is doing is opening up new neuronal pathways, new channels in the heart and mind. And the more we can keep tuning in, touching in to this quality of mudita, the more those pathways open up, become stronger and more available. And at the same time, the opposite channels get denourished. So those pathways that lead more towards what are known as the far enemies of mudita, resentment or envy or jealousy, those start to fade away, wither. So the first stage of this practice is just to recognize the mudita, as we just did. To really feel into it, to know for ourselves, how does mudita feel in this being? And we can also keep priming the pump, so to speak. And here on retreat, it can be a beautiful practice to let yourself keep tuning into any experiences that bring you these little flickers of appreciation, of gratitude, maybe delight. So you might notice, you know, I've been appreciating how many of you in the practice meetings have been expressing gratitude for this retreat. It's a powerful place to start. Some of you have shared just what an amazing opportunity it is to do a 9-day retreat, combining insight practice and insight dialogue with a Zen flavor thanks to Nick, that we get to do that right here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And that can be a powerful reflection to keep in mind, especially when some hindrances might be coming up. You might start to feel those little claws getting into your heart, mind. Or maybe there's a sense of feeling flat or dull or disconnected at times. So you might remember the aspirations that you wrote on opening night. Remember the good fortune of being on this retreat and see if that might bring a little bit of uplift. And I mentioned the other night how mudita can specifically be an antidote to the hindrance of sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor often shows up as kind of apathy or dullness or disconnection. So if you happen to find yourself in that terrain, one antidote I sometimes offer is to take what I call a mudita walk. And this is pretty simple. Just go outside. Let yourself go for a walk around. Open all of the sense doors. And just notice when some kind of experience at any of the sense doors registers as pleasant. And if you notice something like just physically stop, let that pleasant experience in. Fully acknowledge it. Maybe it's the pleasant melodic call of a tui out in the kowhai tree. Maybe it's the pleasantness of feeling the warm sun on your back. Maybe it's the pleasantness of a cool breeze in the middle of the day. Maybe it's the simple feeling of ease and well-being in the body as you walk. Or perhaps the visual beauty of the labyrinth and that arrangement. There are so many moments of pleasant experience that are accessible when we choose to open to them. And of course, there's the meals. The pleasant aftertaste of yet another of Adrienne's incredible creations. Adrienne and the service team providing with us with this regular flow of incredibly delicious food. So there are many different pleasant sense experiences that we can connect with. But as I mentioned the other night, it's important not to stop there. Let that pleasant sense-based pleasure, let it transmute into skillful mental states like mudita, appreciation, gratitude, happiness, contentment. So let the skillful pleasant states, let them kickstart skillful mental qualities, mudita being a crucial one. And in the discourses, the Buddha's teachings, there are lots of words, like we see in the evening chant, where it talks about suffusion with the divine abidings. I notice that in the suttas there are many similar words in relation to skillful qualities. They talk about imbuing, abiding, pervading, saturating, savoring, in my own words, steeping, marinating. But the invitation is to dwell in those skillful qualities, to let them ripen and deepen and strengthen. So let your heart abide in mudita for as long as you can stand it. And in the beginning, that might not be for very long. You know, sadly, again, that cultural conditioning. Many people have almost a mistrust of happiness or joy. There can be a sense, especially if we're in insight tradition, well, it's all impermanent. Why bother? I'm just going to practice preemptive disappointment. I'm not even going to open to that joy in the first place because it's just going to go. Or for some people, there can be a sense of, I don't deserve to be happy. Or a sense that it's self-indulgent to be happy when there's so much suffering around the world. What right do I have to feel any happiness? And there can be a misplaced bonding with people in misery. But in the Buddha's teachings, he often talked about He used the image of quicksand. If somebody's in quicksand, you don't dive in to save them. You keep yourself on firm ground, and only then do you have a better chance of being able to help them. So there can be all these challenges, and I've often shared, you know, my own cultural heritage, having family from the north of England. This is, generally speaking, not a part of the world where people are well known for their effusive, abundant joy. In fact, I don't think I'd even use the word joy until I came into this practice. It wasn't really part of my emotional repertoire when I was a child, when I was growing up. So there are many ways that this practice can challenge some pretty deep conditioning. And yet at the same time, it can be so powerful to open up this possibility and to bring ourselves into the practice. You know, traditionally, mudita is taught as joy for other people's success, good fortune, happiness. And traditionally, we don't practice mudita for ourselves. And when I first heard this, it didn't make sense to me, because as far as I understood, there was nowhere else in the teachings where there was that distinction between self and other. Quite the opposite, everywhere else we're instructed, same, no difference between self and other. So I was confused, and I asked a Pali scholar when I was living in the US what this term mudita literally means, and he said it literally means gladness. So we see that in the chant we've been doing in the evening. And originally there was no sense of gladness for another. It was just simply gladness. And the way we have inherited the practice actually comes from much later in the Buddhist tradition, about 1,000 years after the lifetime of the Buddha, from a text called the Visuddhimagga. And so it's a later development in the Visuddhimagga to only practice mudita for others. So with that as a context, I started exploring, and I found some teachings that the Buddha gave to a layman by the name of Mahanama. And so this layman Mahanama went to the Buddha, and to paraphrase, he said, "You give all these teachings for monastics, but what about offering some teachings that are suitable for people like me who, quote, live in households that are dusty and crowded with children?" So you might get the impression the situation not so conducive to deep samadhi. And the Buddha said yes. And he invited Mahanama, he instructed him, to every day contemplate as often as you remember these six things. Contemplate the good qualities of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and the Devas, or celestial beings. So far, fairly traditional. But then he said, every day contemplate your own generosity and your own virtues or good qualities. And if you contemplate these every day throughout the day, your mind will head straight. And to paraphrase, it will set the mind into highly skillful states, ultimately leading to freedom. So when I first read this teaching, I was kind of horrified by it. Just the idea of cultivating one's own good qualities and celebrating them sounded like a recipe for conceit. But because I was so horrified by it, I thought I should give it a try. And I took it on as a kind of a going against the grain practice. And I was pretty surprised by the effect that it had. I'd assumed that it might make me feel conceited or superior or better than, but it actually made me feel more at ease. I found that when I was more in contact with good qualities in myself, I was much better able to appreciate them in other people, instead of getting caught in comparing mind and coming from that sense of lack or inadequacy. And I was just opening to the full range of what's in here. It's not about ignoring the bad and, you know, positive affirmations, but really discerning the full spectrum of this human being, the full range of what it can manifest. And so when I was able to open to the skillful ones, equally with the not so skillful, I found I was really meeting people from a different place. And it felt much easier to take in their good qualities and strengths when I was more in touch with my own. So I developed a set of phrases for my own mudita practice that acknowledge strengths, good fortune, with the intention that that appreciation might help to open and free the heart and mind. So if this is of interest, I just thought I'd share the phrases that I used and you might develop ones of your own. So I just started to reflect, may I appreciate my own good qualities. May I take joy in this good fortune. May this joy continue. May it grow. May it lead to ever-deepening ease and freedom. So it's not just grooving on joy for its own sake, it has a purpose. So if you're working for other people, may I appreciate your good qualities. May I take joy in your good fortune. May your joy continue. May it grow. May it lead to ever-deepening ease and freedom. So there's just some possible phrases, and if phrases work for you with these practices, great. And if they don't, then you might just practice abiding in the energetic quality of mudita, maybe using the small child or the dog or the dolphin or some experience in your own life as a kind of kindling. And then let that mudita abide, pervade around the world, abiding, suffusing, dwelling in all the blessings of your life. So this too is an aspect of mudita, to be in contact with our own blessings. And some of you know that traditionally on retreat, we sometimes chant the sharing of blessings. We chose not to do it on this retreat because we've got the two Brahmavihara ones. But in that blessings chant, we were doing it back in the two-week retreat with Willa and Elizabeth. And, you know, as quite often happens, we hear phrases from the suttas or the teachings 10 times, 100 times. Oh, yeah, that's nice. And then the thousandth time, doing. And I was doing this chant, and this one particular line just suddenly jumped out. And until that time, I just thought it was another nice Buddhist intention, but it didn't have any, not that much real meaning for me. And that phrase was, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. And on that particular night, it suddenly hit me. My life does have blessings. It has many blessings. And it felt quite miraculous when I started to open to just how radically my life has changed for the better since I got involved in this path. And on that night, I felt a surge of fully knowing the blessings of my life, almost for the first time. And there were just so many blessings that I naturally wanted to share them with others. So as this talk comes to an end, I just invite you to reflect for a moment in silence. Are there blessings in your life too? Just taking a moment to sense into that. Can you contact some of the many blessings in your life? And as you touch into these blessings, how does it feel at the heart center or anywhere in the body? Might there be a sense of uplift or openness or lightness, expansiveness or warmth? Just to see. if you are able to touch that sense of blessings. Maybe there's a natural sense of them growing and gathering. In a sense that may they be shared by all beings. So that's my hope. May all beings receive the blessings of all our lives. The contribution to the welfare, the happiness, the freedom of all beings everywhere. May we know kindness. May we know compassion. May we know appreciative joy. And may we know the highest equanimity, which is peace.